Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. I'm Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and we have a power-packed schedule of national and international political figures on today's show. Over the weekend, we were out collecting interviews from the Civitas Institute's 2017 Conservative Leadership Conference in Raleigh, North Carolina. So, first up this week, we have Marjorie Dannenfelser. She's the president of Susan B. Anthony List, which is an American political organization that seeks to advance pro-life leaders in politics. She's going to come on and talk to us about what her organization is doing to elect pro-life politicians who will then go forward and pass pro-life legislation. Next up, we have Anne McElhaney, who is an Irish documentarian and journalist, most notably known for her work on Frack Nation, to talk about her new project, which is a book and movie, both of the same title, called Gosnell, about Kermit Gosnell, a Philadelphia doctor who was serving three consecutive life sentences for performing, quote-unquote, abortions on live-born children. She will talk about the book, which is a true crime telling of what happened in Philadelphia in the 80s and 90s when this was taking place, and also talk about the movie Gosnell, which is a feature film drama about the same topic. Then we'll have on Amity Schles, who is an author known for her work on President Calvin Coolidge's life and his administration. She's also the president of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, and she is coming on to talk about her new project, which is to write about the social program reforms of the 60s, giving it the same treatment that she did in her book, The Forgotten Man, talking about the Great Depression and the reforms that Hoover and Roosevelt installed during the Great Depression. Thank you for joining us again on What Matters in North Carolina, and we will move right into Marjorie Dannenfelser with Susan B. Anthony List right now. This is Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and I'm across the table from Marjorie Dannenfelser.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
With the Susan B. Anthony List, and she's just gotten off the stage for her segment at the Civitas Conservative Leadership Conference. And how did things go for you there?
Oh, it was great. You know, Anne McElhaney always, if she speaks before me, she always makes me cry. So that was good. After I cleaned up my mascara, we got to work on pro-life strategy and winning elections. And so that was the core of what I was talking about.
Right. And that's definitely a good pairing to go together. Because, I mean, so we're here, you know, it's a state-based show. Mm-hmm. Susan B. Anthony List, of course, coming out of D.C. Can you talk a little about what your organization does?
Sure. We are the national organization that really focuses on the strategy for winning national elections and U.S. Senate seats and House seats, so very federally oriented. And the principle behind beginning with elections, which we do, is that it's vital to begin with elections, which they must lead to legislation, which then leads to the next election, which then leads to next legislation. It must be integrated. Otherwise, once you've lobbied on the pro-life issue, once you've the pro-life movement, as has happened in North Carolina and Susan B. Anthony List's efforts, elects a candidate, if you don't connect it with a strong legislative strategy, it kind of gets forgotten, and it's very easy to forget. So a good message, a good voter turnout strategy, a good legislative agenda, and enough money to power that whole machine is vital for the pro-life issue to win.
Right. So really, Susan B. Anthony List is looking for the front to back, everything all-inclusive from start to finish process of getting pro-life legislation going, from pro-life legislators to doing the work and getting T's crossed and I's dotted.
That's right. And I think, I mean, North Carolina is a perfect example. I mean, I have a bias toward it because I'm from Greenville. But also, it's been a very important state for the whole nation for quite some time. So in 2014 and in 2016, we had canvassers going across the state from coast to mountains visiting homes of our likely voters. Whether they are Hispanics, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, many of the voters that we reach are not generally targets of the Republican Party, and our goal is to motivate them to vote on Election Day. So when we've done that with Senator Tillis and Senator Burr, they were our friends before, certainly, but without question, we are very, very strong allies in Washington now. Senator Tillis and I are on a texting friendship basis, and I don't say that to say, oh, how great am I? I say that so that it's well communicated that this is a very important partnership where he is very close to the strategy of the pro-life movement.
Right, and so why is this issue so important now, or is it growing in importance still? I mean, where kind of where is all that
at? No doubt it is growing in importance. And the purpose of the strategy that I just described was to strengthen the muscle and the arm of the pro-life movement so that not only taking that position would be the right thing to do, but it'd be the smart political thing to do. And it has become more and more apparent to Democrats and independents, mainly Democrats that are in office, that their litmus test on this issue is hurting them at the polls. This is what Nancy Pelosi was very direct in saying very recently, that there should be no Democratic litmus test on the abortion issue, that the reason that Trump won was because of evangelical, Catholic, and pro-life voters, and that the Democratic Party has some work to do on this issue. This is not how they were talking just a year ago. We are very strong now as a movement, and it's important because it's the central human rights battle of our time.
And are you seeing more of a, I would say, a resurgence in younger generations of pro-life idea? It seemed like there was the advent of the 60s and 70s kids that were very pro-choice, my body, my choice, all of this. And then are you seeing that shifting now in the younger generations?
Yes, it's very astute that it is exactly the case. And there are a couple of factors involved. Experience is one. Sonograms. Young people who saw their siblings' sonograms on the refrigerator. It's a little bit hard to ignore that you're looking at your brother, not just a mass of cells, or your sister, and to feel protective. People have grown up seeing that now. And so the young people of today see this, not all, of course, but increasing numbers see this as their civil rights moment, as their political activism. I'm going to live for something worthwhile, and saving the life of another person is a pretty darn good reason to get engaged and involved. Not only is that anecdotal evidence available wherever you look, especially at the March for Life, but you can definitely see it even in our own targeting of who our best voters are in Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, battleground states. They tend to be younger. They tend to be female over men, and generally and Hispanics. Those are our best voters in these battleground states. That says a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And I think mentioning the advancement of technology for sonograms is a big part of it. I have a daughter who's under two, so I very well still remember being in there in the room, and we get the little images. She looks like a little peanut waving at me. And this is, you know, before, you know, 12 weeks or so. I mean, this is very, very early in the pregnancy.
Yeah.
So we know more now about the process from conception to birth than I think past generations. And even so the information's out there. And that's one thing you talked about. But it seems that there's just this realizing of this, you know, was a bundle of cells,
right?
That people know it's not true. They know they've been fooled, or past generations have been fooled.
That's
and
right.
There's a rebellion against that, I would think.
It is definitely happening. I mean, we were all a zygote once, you know. That's a great t-shirt. Maybe we'll make one day. We all started like that. The idea that either of us were just a clump of cells, you might call us that. You might call us really, really young, the youngest that you could be. That realization, and I, the way you describe the experience is so perfect and so vital and so central to this success, that I don't know that we would have gotten there without science. But isn't that great? That one of the core reasons that we are where we are is because of the development of science and understanding. Because out of sight, out of mind has undermined many human rights movements. But this one in particular is vulnerable to that because the baby is out of sight and it's very easy to be out of mind. Unless you're tracking that sonogram. So that's why people are for ultrasound bills. That's for why the pro-life movement, it's important to describe at 20 weeks, which is sort of the federal level, probably next step. It's our top legislative priority, that at 20 weeks, that's when mothers are told by their doctors to start singing to their child, that he or she can hear, that they resonate to her voice already, that they have eyebrows, that their vision is becoming a little bit more acute. It's amazing that what you know affects your behavior, and that's a good thing.
And right, and I think about 20 weeks. You know, halfway through pregnancy, we had a one of those really cool 4D, smoothed out images. So I mean, I saw my daughter's face at that time.
It gives you chills, doesn't it?
It does when I think about in contrast to somebody could walk in, and they could end that life.
Yeah.
And I also think about in another way what's become kind of more popular is when as part of the grieving process for a miscarriage, people will hold funerals for their miscarried child.
That's right.
So how can we on the one side say, this isn't a person, you can have an abortion, and then at the other side say, you can have a funeral for your miscarried child?
That's exactly that is the core question. It's all in the mind of the want of the person who wants or doesn't want. And I think more and more, though, because of what you just described, even if I don't want, I realize I'm dealing not with an appendicitis, an appendix that has to be removed, but a human being with equal dignity and equal rights with me. And that is the struggle. That is the core of the human rights struggle that you just described. And that's been the core of every other successful human rights movement since the beginning of the founding. Child labor laws, abolition, voting rights for different populations. It's always been about the dignity of the human being. And when we realize it, when we look at it, when we're forced to look at it, America responds well. And I really think that when we get this right, many other things will follow. I always learned that, you know, you get one virtue, you try to practice it and do really well, and you kind of start to perfect that a little, then a lot of other ones follow. I think nothing more true for the pro-life movement leading the nation into embracing liberty in other places.
All right. Well, thank you. That wraps it up. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polscher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. I'm sitting here with Anne McElhaney, who's the producer of Gosnell, her most recent film, but is also very well known for her work on Frack Nation. And she also has a book by the same name of Gosnell about her movie, or about the topic about her movie. And I want to give you a chance to kind of introduce for you what this movie and book is about.
Hi there, Matt. It's great to be here. My third year at CLC. I always love being here. Gosnell is an extraordinary and awful story about a doctor, Dr. Kermit Gosnell, who is serving 3 life sentences in a prison in Pennsylvania right now for delivering babies alive and cutting their necks with scissors. And he's serving 3 life sentences for 3 babies that were identified. However, there is no doubt, and there was no doubt in the minds of the jury and those investigating who combed through this extraordinary evidence and the grand jury, that in fact this is America's greatest, biggest serial killer, most prolific serial killer, that he probably in his lifetime killed thousands of babies in this way, born alive, crying, one of them trying to swim for safety in a toilet. And the descriptions are graphic and multitudinous. And then his modus operandi was that he would cut their necks with the scissors, and he did this, as I said, for over 30 years. I'd highly recommend the book. It's a New York Times bestseller now, despite the fact that the New York Times didn't want to have it on its New York Times bestselling list. You'll find it, actually, in the true crime section in bookstores, because this is a true crime story, and actually one of the worst crime stories in American history. And an added interesting detail that I think a lot of your audience would understand and appreciate, and not in a good way, is that the media chose not to report on this story, despite the fact that this story has all the elements of things that the progressive movement say they care about. You know, there is the death of Karnemiah Monger, a Bhutanese refugee who spent 20 years in a refugee camp in Nepal, came to America and was dead 4 months after she got here, after a botched abortion at Dr. Kermit Gosnell's clinic. And the progressive movement didn't think that was worth reporting on. Samika Shaw died in 2000, a young African-American woman, a mother, and she also died in a similar fashion. And no one seems to care. The progressive movement don't seem to care. It's amazing, actually. Philadelphia is a sanctuary city. A sanctuary city that did not give much sanctuary to Karnemiah Monger. And whose death didn't seem to bother all these progressives in Philadelphia, who claim to care so much for the very people that were the victims in this particular story. A lot of the children killed were also African-American. It's almost like a genocide, what went on here. The vast majority were African-American, and yet we're not hearing Black Lives Matters having much to say about those Black Lives. So there's a lot to know here. I'd highly recommend the book. It's an extraordinary page-turner. That's what people have told us. We have, you know, interviews with all of the lead investigators. We have interviews with some of the victims. We have interviews with people who worked in the clinic who also spent time in prison. And we have a lot of information from the trial itself and from the grand jury investigation. And I think it's really important that people read this book, because what we don't know will actually hurt us.
Right. And it's such a hard topic to even wrap your brain around, in this idea that this is going on, the scope of it, and it happening, you know, in America, in Philadelphia, for all this time. I think that it's really hard to believe. So the fact that it's in the true crime section is really a good thing. It's even for me. I mean, I personally am a father of a daughter who's just over a year old, and it is mind-boggling to me personally, and I'm sure so many people, that this is happening. So when was Gosnell active? Like, what time periods? Like, when was he stopped and that sort of thing?
So he went to prison, you know, just a couple of years ago, but he operated for the 30 years previous to that. So, you know, he was operating this clinic in broad daylight. You know, it was murder in plain sight. It's kind of extraordinary, you know, that this happened. I mean, he went to prison in 2014, and you know, it's just amazing. It's amazing that he got away with this for so long, and that's one of the things that we really highlight in the book. I mean, one of the really extraordinary, you know, there's an extraordinary number of extraordinary facts, but one of the most extraordinary of all of them is the fact that the Department of Health didn't examine the clinic for 17 years, even though Samika Shaw died, even though Karnamaya Monger died. And, you know, you have to ask, and this was asked in the grand jury by one of the ADAs, Assistant District Attorney Christine Wexler, you know, what exactly had to happen in that clinic for the Department of Health in Harrisburg to care? So, you know, it wasn't like people weren't making complaints. There were, you know, huge number of complaints, including doctors at local area hospitals who had written handwritten complaints to the Department of Health. But, you know, even putting that aside, and there were an enormous number of complaints and lawsuits that were settled by the state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Despite all of that, the idea that two people died and that bureaucrats in Harrisburg, bureaucrats, by the way, in the Department of Health, many of them nurses, by the way, many of them with medical backgrounds, that they didn't feel motivated to get into their cars and drive and find out what was going on. You know, in one case, during one of the most, you know, one of the most graphic and most serious complaints, the only action that was done by Harrisburg was to meet Gosnell off campus. To meet him in King of Prussia, some people would know it's an area outside of Philadelphia. You know, they allowed him to be met off campus to explain himself. He, of course, is a great fabulist and a great storyteller and charming, and he charmed them, and they let it go, and that was the end of that. And they were satisfied with his answers, and they moved on. And as I said, the two women died. But also the bodies were literally piling up in the basement. And they were literally piling up in the basement. And what's amazing, and I suppose what's in the midst of all this darkness, there is light in this story, by the way. And that light comes in the shape of Detective Jim Wood, you know, a regular cop, you know, Philadelphia cop, exactly what that conjures up in your brain, you know, from a large family, Catholic, just a really good guy who is not a homicide detective. He is actually he's on the drug task force with the DA's office. And it took him to care for Karnamaya Monger's death and to pursue the investigation into her death and to not allow this to be swept under the carpet. It's only because of him that Gosnell is in prison. So I highly recommend the book. It was very tough writing it. I mean, I cried many times at the computer just recounting the stories, particularly the story of baby boy A. you know, extraordinary. Born in 2008 on the 12th of July and shares a birthday with my own father. He lived and died, obviously, on the same day, but he did live. And he had such an effect on the workers that three of them took a photograph of him. And that photograph eventually nailed Gosnell's fate and eventually made sure that he went to prison. But baby boy A, despite his very short life, I think could have a massive impact in America and around the world because he struggled for life. And as I said, he had such an impact on the workers that they took these photographs. And Adrian Moten, one of the workers who took the photograph, who I've interviewed, you know, she kept the phone, you know, the way you get a phone and then the phone gets old and you throw it out or whatever. No, she never threw it out. She kept the phone. And when the cops eventually caught up with her, she handed the phone over and said, "You're going to want to watch that. You're going to have a look. There's a photograph there." And her remark after that was, "Now I'm free. Now finally I'm free." That she had kept the photograph for all those years and that it had haunted her, actually. And she went to prison and, in fact, says that the worst part about being in prison was the dark, because she would see baby boy A. And the minute they turned the lights out, he would appear to her, and that she would say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
That's powerful there. I mean, so when did you start the projects, the book and the movie? When did you start those projects?
You know, it's an amazing story. I mean, we had done a documentary, as you mentioned earlier, called Frack Nation, about the fracking miracle that's happening across America, and particularly in Pennsylvania, which is kind of the heart of the kind of ground zero for a lot of the controversy connected with false controversy, by the way, connected with fracking, based on a documentary by Josh Fox called Gasland. And, you know, we had made this documentary called Frack Nation, and Phelan, my husband, who is at front of camera and the presenter of the documentary, was traveling around the country having screenings, talking to people, and he was on a kind of a tour of Pennsylvania and by accident ended up in Philadelphia. I mean, a lot of people that listen to your show, I'm sure, are religious folk and will probably see the hand of God in that, and I certainly do. And Phelan was there in Philadelphia very, very accidentally, very strangely, and had a couple of days that he didn't have anything to do, and he heard about a local crime story, as it was described, a local crime story. That's how Sarah Schiff from the Washington Post, by the way, described it and explained why she hadn't covered it, by the way. So, local crime story. And Phelan went into this courtroom, which was empty, literally empty. There were very few people there, and basically only a couple of local journalists. You know, no national press was there. And he heard, and he's been a reporter for years. I mean, he worked in Northern Ireland during the war there, during the Troubles, as they call it. So he's seen a lot and heard a lot in his life. He's not, you know, he's no... And he sat there and saw and heard the worst things he'd ever seen or heard, the worst testimony, the worst evidence. What they did was they set up a slideshow projector, and they projected the images of the dead children in front of the jury during the trial as a way of illustrating exactly how they had died, showing the cut at the back of the necks of the babies and all of that. So he was sitting there watching that. As he says himself, the more shocking thing and the more very disturbing thing was that he turned around to see these press benches, empty press benches. And because of the severity of the story, because of the extraordinary nature of these stories, they had reserved, the prosecution had reserved a particularly large courtroom in Philadelphia because they expected a massive crowd of journalists for a story with such a huge amount of newsworthy aspects to it. And, you know, and so they actually had, and we have it in the film as well, they had these notices on the benches saying reserved for journalists, and that section that was reserved for journalists, bank upon bank of chairs, was empty. Those benches were empty. And he said that was really disturbing. He came back to Los Angeles, where we live, and told us the story. And Magda, who is our other partner in the business, the other producer of this film, you know, Phelan said, "We have to do something about this." And both Magda and I both said, "We don't want anything to do with abortion. We do not want anything to do with abortion. We have, you know, it's not our thing. It's not our shtick. A lot of the stuff that we do, we like doing stories about environmentalists, but we have no interest in this." And Phelan said, I would just ask you, what I'm going to do is let me just buy 3 days of the court transcripts, of the transcripts that I heard when I was there. And you can purchase them. And he did. And we read them. And that was that. I mean, we were more rabid about doing this than he was after we had read the transcripts. And the idea that no one was reporting on this, we're journalists and, you know, we're proud of being journalists, and it's a responsibility and a privilege. But if you you know, if you don't report the news, I mean, you don't deserve to be a journalist. So we're very happy, you know, and privileged to get to do this, despite the fact that this is an awful story.
Right. And what you said about, you know, not wanting to get near the topic of abortion is, in this day and age, is so true across the board that I mean, that's why the story wasn't covered. I'm sure that's why it didn't get that much attention, because there's so much of a fear of going near that topic. So what resistance did you run into in this project going into that topic?
It's been amazing. I mean, I remember somebody saying very, very near the beginning about somebody saying to me, you know, you think you've had it hard, you know, taking on environmentalists. You ain't seen nothing yet. You know, you ain't seen trouble till you go after Planned Parenthood, till you have to go after pro-abortionists, you know. And my God, is that true? I mean, we've had all kinds of things and kind of surprising things, even amongst, you know, fans of ours, if you like, people who've really liked our work, who, you know, basically said, that's me, I'm done with you now, you know. We've had a fair bit of that. But we've also had, you know, obviously the mainstream. For example, so the book came out in January, and within 48 hours, it sold out everywhere. It sold out in Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, and on Amazon, like complete gone. There were no books. And it came up. It was a complete disaster for us, obviously, because on Amazon, it came up and said, oh, you know, it'll be 6 weeks before you get your, you know, they're going to have to reprint and everything. We trended on Amazon. We were at number three in all categories of books being sold. We were number three within 48 hours. And yet we did not appear on the New York Times bestseller list at number three or four or five or six or seven or eight or anywhere on the hardback bestseller list, which we should have been by numbers. And then we discovered we are now on the bestsellers list, the New York Times bestseller list. However, what we discovered, which is kind of news and kind of funny, really, when you think about it, because people talk about fake news and how, you know, the New York Times is a fake newspaper with fake journalists telling fake stories. And here's a fake story for you. The bestseller list in the New York Times is not made up of bestsellers. And I just think that that's an interesting thing. They don't use numbers to work out what to put on the list. I know, you literally cannot make this stuff up. This is not me. This is not me reporting from The Onion right now. This is a true story. The New York Times do not use numbers, just raw data, in order to work out the bestseller list. And they weight their readers. So you're more weighty and you're more valuable if you're a reader in New York than you are if you're in Wichita. So it's just good to know. But we are on the list, and it does unfortunately matter. I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, it sounds like there was a lot of blowback from different areas. So as far as the book and the movie, if someone's going to only see one, which we hope they would see both, but if someone's only going to see one, would you rather they read the book or watch the movie? Which do you think would have more value to them, I guess? I'm trying to word it.
That's a really hard question for me to answer. You know, I suppose for sure the movie is much more accessible than the book. I would say that it's much more accessible. You know, people have, you know, it has a life changing effect watching the film. And we've had that experience with people who've told us that. We believe it has already saved lives, by the way. We have had amazing testimony, people writing to us, explaining the effect that this had by seeing the film. And very few people have seen it. A few hundred people across the country have seen it. We've been showing it to small audiences of sort of, you know, leaders, thought leaders, so that when the movie actually comes out in theatres, that they will tell people. So I don't like your question. People should buy the book and see the film. And they're very different, actually, funny enough. Maybe that's an important thing to say. They're very, very different. The book is forensic. The book is very detailed and very forensic. You know, and it is very much a true crime story. A lot of testimony taken directly from the transcripts of the trial, interviews with cops, whereas the movie is a movie. It's, you know, like a Hollywood movie. Nothing happens in the movie that didn't happen in real life. But obviously in a movie, you have to concentrate and distill and edit out, you know, and we left out things. I think it's important maybe to say to your audience that we left out things that we thought were too difficult for people to watch. So there is nothing, there's no images. We don't show anything in the film. You don't see anything, because we thought that was really important. But even more than that, we don't even tell everything in the film, because, you know, in the telling of this, it's hard. And, you know, there's no doubt about it. I've had people write and say that they've had to put the book down repeatedly and put it back, read it back up. But I would suggest that the book is very like, you know, it's like reading the Holocaust, you know, like reading stories from, you know, Mengele. you know, yes, it's terrible, but it's important, and it happened. And it didn't happen in a backwater. It happened in progressive Pennsylvania, progressive Philadelphia, and it didn't happen, you know, in the 17th century. You know, this is the 21st century. This happened now. This happened right now. And you know, people need to know exactly what happened. And actually, you know, it's all in the details.
Right. So my question about the Gosling movie then is the format a documentary format? Or it is a cinematic story?
Yeah, it's a movie. It's a movie. It's directed by Nick Searcy, actually one of your own, a North Carolina native. And the lead actor is Dean Cain, who a lot of people know, young Superman. Sarah Jane Morris, you know, not a name many people might recognize, but her face people would recognize from CSI, from Criminal Minds. Really, really great actor. And as I said, Nick Searcy, who directs the film, is also acting in the film. And he would be well known and loved, obviously, here in North Carolina. And, you know, we have Michael Beach, another actor that a lot of people will recognize. Michael Beach, really wonderful actor. And we have an amazing cast. We, you know, we had very little money. We obviously did a crowdfunding campaign for this film. We raised $2.3 million from 29,000 people across the country. And people can continue to help us because we have problems trying to get this film out. So anyone who's listening who could help, just go to gosnellmovie.com. gosnellmovie.com, and you know, give us even a dollar if you believe in the importance of this story being told. And if you want to buy the book, just go to gosnellbook.com and you can buy the book there. But gosnellmovie.com, gosnellbook.com, and any help that you can give, we would be most grateful. We don't think 29,000 people should be the number of people that made this film possible. It should be 150,000 people, 250,000 people. And just give a dollar. Even if you give a dollar, it's enough. But obviously, if you can give more, we'd appreciate it.
All right, and that is a really good point to bring up, because in contrast to, you know, Frack Nation being a documentary, it's very different. I think that people who know you from Frack Nation would assume it was a documentary. So it's a really great point to make, that it is a story. It is a produced.
It's a cinematic story. Yeah, with music and with great actors and it's, you know, we've had people who've seen it have been really blown away by the production values, what we were able to do with so little money. You know, most of these, you know, most movies are, you know, $10 or $20 million. So, you know, we spent about $2 million, and you know, we're really proud of what's been achieved here.
All right. Well, I look forward to watching, and I'm going to catch it today. And
thank you.
And thank you for spending time with us. We went a little over our time, but I think it was a good time. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. I'm Matt Calder, here at the Civitas Conservative Leadership Conference, across the table from Amity Schles, who is here to talk to us at the conference and talk to us here on the radio about Calvin Coolidge and a lot of the lessons we can learn from President Coolidge. How are you doing today, Amity?
I'm fine and happy to be here.
Good deal, good deal. So the first thing I want to kind of get into is, what lessons can we learn from President Coolidge, and especially in light of how he was, I think, the last president to be able to actually cut spending?
Yes, Calvin Coolidge served for 67 months from 1923 into 1929. And when he left office, the federal budget was actually lower than when he came in. Today, our lawmakers speak of budget cuts, and they mean precisely reductions in increases. Coolidge actually cut the budget. The number was lower, both real and nominally.
And how was he able to do this, and is that type of cut possible today?
One reason Coolidge could cut the budget was a law given to him by his predecessor, Warren Harding, called the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921, and that law gave the executive some authority, including the authority to impound, that is, to hold back money that might have been voted to be allocated, appropriations, but which in his judgment the president felt maybe ought not to be spent after all. So he'd say, well, I promised you 2 battleships, but I see you really need only 1.5. I promised you 2 pencils, but I see you haven't even got started on the second one, or you've used half of it. I'll take the stub. So that's extraordinary authority for the executive. In addition, there was something else which is inchoate and a strange thing to talk about in policy, which is Coolidge imparted a sense of responsibility to his executive branch. And part of that was they had a meeting every half year of the executive branch. So you want to imagine the cabinet secretary sitting there and the president and his budget director on the stage and the staffs of the cabinet directors behind. And then the administration, that is the president and especially his budget director, would berate the poor cabinets if they didn't save enough. So that's the factor of responsibility and or shame that's missing today in our technocratic world. So he would say, here's the prize for the department, the 2% club, that managed to cut an extra 2% of its budget above and beyond what was asked. What do you get? A sticker? As in second grade. And here's the prize. After a while, it became hard to cut because years pass and the country grows, for the department that managed to cut 1% of its budget extra, even though it wasn't asked, and you get another sticker. I mean, who knows? But he really very much believed in rallying, in cheering people on, in the kind of, halftime event of a rally in a football game. And after a while, they couldn't even get people to save 1% in their department. So they created a woodpecker club for that meritorious department that managed to cut its budget here and there, like a woodpecker. That reflects the New England background of the president. But in any case, long story short, what's going on is he's not just saying cut. He's saying, I mean it. The way one does with children or congressmen.
Okay, so I mean, a lot of personal responsibility face to face. You have to answer to the president for what you've done and if you've done a good job. And that's something that's definitely missing in our society in all places, not just politics.
So, right, he held them to the responsibility. And in addition, I want to say Coolidge lived by example, so he didn't spend a lot either. And when his predecessor was Warren Harding, and Warren Harding's White House was known for open quote, action. Close quote. What does that mean? Action. Food in action sometimes. Coolidge's White House was an austere place, and he really didn't like the housekeeper, Mrs. Jaffray. She spent quite a bit, and she went to the fancy shops, and one day she had a dinner all laid out for a diplomatic event, and it was pork, it was ham, and the president, she said, what do you think, Mr. President? He said it looked like an awful lot of pork to him. That is, I'm not sure I would have spent so much on these visiting dignitaries. And he actually replaced the housekeeper with a thriftier lady from New England who saved several thousand on the budget each year of the household, food and services, of the catering of the White House. So he, right down to the detail, Coolidge didn't even own a house because he didn't want to owe a mortgage while he was president, because he didn't want to be politically indebted to a bank. He lived a virtuous life as best he could, and the people understood that. And the final point I'll add was he wasn't just being thrifty to be Scrooge. What he was saying is a Scrooge can beget plenty. So he said, I want the government to spend less so that people can have more for themselves. That's the true meaning of freedom. So he made the moral case for the government limits, the checks, the cutbacks as well. And you never hear that. You just hear the poor government employees have to turn the lights out or might have to go on holiday or something like that. Now, there's never any thought for the citizen who is paying the government employee in the Washington discussion.
Right. And we see that same sort of idea with especially our Senate here in the state of North Carolina. They talk about a $1 billion tax cut, but it is, at the end of the day, a cut to spending growth as opposed to an actual hard number. It was here last year, and it's a little lower this coming year. So we're still, I mean, even in very conservative or more conservative areas, not seeing that kind of Coolidge cut.
Well, one of the reasons, you know, you want to ask yourself why he had to do that and why Coolidge succeeded then in the 1920s, now in 2017. One reason was the U.S. was not certain in its position as the leading power of the world. And then we had a gold standard system then. What happened when your budget got out of control, your federal budget, in a gold standard system? The money would go elsewhere. The gold would go on a boat to England or France. And that would force an automatic contraction in the money supply, thereby forcing interest rates up and a recession in your country. So you had a penalty for having a deficit budget. You had a penalty for that you felt in interest rates. So nowadays, these connections are much vaguer. The dollar is king, and interest rates are always low until they're not. And nothing seems to hurt. Right, there's no real punishment for the government making commitments it cannot keep. That, of course, will end because eventually the dollar will have competition. Some of us are looking at the Bitcoin and other products right now. Maybe it'll be something else, a combo of a country and a company. But for the moment, everything we do feels harmless, and therefore there's less pressure upon the lawmakers.
Okay, so and now you've been a couple of years separated from your more recent book on Coolidge. But you have a new project going, don't you?
I do.
You want to tell us a little about that?
Well, a while ago, I wrote a book about the Great Depression called Forgotten Man. And in Forgotten Man, I looked at the New Deal, which was the program of the Democrats, of Franklin Roosevelt, in the 30s to try to bring the country out of the Great Depression. Actually, I also include a Republican, Herbert Hoover, in that story because it's a story of intervention and planning and whether that actually benefits the country. And I concluded in that book that the New Deal did not help the country, as well-intentioned as it was. This is a corollary book on the Great Society, which is the 60s program to make everything better. Much different program because we weren't in a Great Depression in the 60s. What we said is we're rich enough to do more and improve the quality of the life of Americans. The Great Society was, however, an ambitious program. We live in Lyndon Johnson's America, as my fellow author Joe Califano says. We live in the America of the Great Society as created by the FDR of the 60s, LBJ. So what was that? You know, Medicare, Medicaid, intervention in cities, all these things. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac really essentially come out of the 60s culture. What was the impetus there and what was the result? And what I'm finding is the impetus was the same as in the 30s, notwithstanding the economy. It was, we want to do good for more people. And the result was planning from above. Well, it's not always optimal and the result isn't always happy. You can aim to do things for poor people or blacks or for society and not always succeed. A good part of the Great Society was pure folly.
Right, definitely. What always strikes me about these issues, like you talk about the Depression, you wrote your book mentioning, you know, FDR and also Hoover, is how history remembers presidents from that time area and the reputation that Hoover gets and the blame that he gets, the Hoovervilles versus FDR and the New Deal. And what did you find most interesting about, I guess, that in the Great Depression era, about the way executives and the leadership was seen?
Well, more looking back, in the day they knew that Hoover and Roosevelt were alike. Hoover was a Republican reformer and Roosevelt was a Democratic reformer, and they were both worried about the budget deficit. They were both fine gentlemen. But what we learned in school was Hoover down, Roosevelt up. Just as with when you're ranking athletes, someone's first and someone's last, the ranking system forced you to do that. So we do that with presidents as well. And so Hoover was forced way down just for the sake of him being down, and people forgot the similarities between FDR and Hoover and that their results were similar. Roosevelt had good growth rates year over year, and we often focus on growth year over year, but from a tiny base. And the long story short, the economy did not get back on a per capita basis, which is how we count it, because the number of people in the country changes, until really 39-40. So that's a failure. The stock market did not get back to its 1929 level until the 50s. Well, gee, the 1920s stock market can't have been so high that it was a whole generation too high. What does that tell us? The stock market loss heart in the New Deal.
All right. So when can we look for something from your from this most recent project on LBJ and the Great Society?
Well, I just received an email from my editor, Jonathan Jayo of HarperCollins, and he said, I expect two more chapters by July 15, Amity. So I'm hoping next year. The thing that I also want to mention, if I may, is for Coolidge. I'm also chairman of the Coolidge Foundation, and I'm here to talk a little bit about Coolidge. One of the things we've done, President Coolidge is an awesome president. If he were a stock, he'd be a buy. He's so mispriced. And so we're doing presently two things to advance his name among young people and his model. The first is we've created a merit scholarship that's a full ride to any college. And we have named six so far. That means any college in the United States, and the purpose is to honor Coolidge, who believed in merit and believed that you can't help the weak by pulling down the strong. And we had 15,000 young people sign up to apply for this scholarship. 2,500 actually did the whole application, which is onerous and requires an essay about Calvin Coolidge, of course. So it's become, the Coolidge is becoming the Rhodes Scholarship of the United States, but for undergraduates. We're very proud of that, and Calvin is too. We have wonderful winners this year. One is a homeschooler, one lives out west in California, and one is from the Ann Arbor area. So the winners come from all over the country, as do the candidates. The second thing I wanted to mention is particularly our North Carolina friends are eager to get Coolidge a house in Washington so that all school children may parade through and learn about the president who cut the budget, and he'll be better known, and I'm very supportive of that as chairman of the Coolidge Foundation. It's a wonderfully exciting venture to give Coolidge a place so you don't just see Roosevelt and maybe President Wilson. There's a Wilson house. It's Americans need alternate models. They need Reagan. They need Eisenhower. A monument is being redone right now, being built, and they need Coolidge.
All right. Well, thank you. I know you have a tight schedule, but thank you for taking the time with us today.
Oh, sure. No, thank you, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Thank you for joining us on another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you to Amity Slays for talking with us about Calvin Coolidge and telling us about all the great things he did, shrinking the budget, not just stopping or reducing spending growth, but actually shrinking the budget to a lower level than it was when he moved into office. Thank you to her also for talking with us about her upcoming project on the social reforms of the 60s and also talking to us about the scholarship that the Coolidge Foundation has put forth, which will send a student to any United States college of their choice on a full ride, which is a pretty big deal for students looking for those scholarships out there. Of course, thank you to Ann McElhaney for sitting down with us for a little longer than she was supposed to be there, actually. But she was gracious enough to take the time and sit down and talk with us about her movie, her book, and a lot of detail that is pretty great considering the movie's not officially released yet. It's only been screened a few different times across the nation for a few different people, so we'll definitely take that. And thank you to Marjorie Dannenfels for Susan B. Anthony List for giving us an update on how things are going with her organization and letting us know all the great things that the Susan B. Anthony List is doing to work for the pro-life cause. Looking forward to next week, we will have former Governor Pat McCrory on the show to talk about what he's been up to since losing his re-election campaign. We'll have Hans Savon Spakovsky with the Heritage Foundation on to talk about voting rights and voter ID and all things voting. And we'll also have on George Landreth with Frontiers of Freedom to talk about his recent article on why on-campus recruiting for jobs is not discriminatory, even though there are those who say that it is. To keep up with what we are doing on this show and the others, go to freedomactionnetwork.com, where you can check out old shows, the current show, or you can check out the other shows, NC Gun Dad and Free to Brew. NC Gun Dad is hosted by me, Matt Calder, and Free to Brew is hosted by our own Greg Polscher. You can also follow us online on Facebook at What Matters NC or on Twitter at What Matters NC. Again, on Facebook and Twitter, that is What Matters NC. And if you're looking for us online, go to freedomactionnetwork.com. Again, that is freedomactionnetwork.com. Join us again next week.